Introduce me, I'm Erin Blasby. I'm finishing up my master's at Monmouth, and I'm going to be doing your lecture tonight on comfort and pain management. Okay, so the first thing we're going to talk about is pain. Pain itself is unpleasant, subjective, sensory and emotional experience that's associated with an actual or potential tissue damage. So pain itself is subjective. That means that it's really hard to get an accurate measurement of what someone is experiencing. It can be a factor inhibiting the ability and willingness to recover from an illness. So how many of you can think of a time when you've had pain? I'm sure everyone in here has had pain at some point or another. If you're in pain, you're not really going to want to do too much. I know that, you know, when I was in labor pain, I really didn't want to do anything. And it can really inhibit a person from the recovery process. Comfort is a concept that's central to the art of nursing. Through comfort measures, nurses provide strength, hope, solace, support, encouragement, and assistance. So that's a lot of stuff that we as nurses can provide our patients. Comfort is just as subjective as pain, so it's hard to put key identifiers of what comfort really is. Pain is whatever the experiencing person says it is, and it exists whenever the person says it does. And we as nurses, we're going to talk about this a little bit tonight, have to put our biases aside about what we think pain is. We have to listen to our patients and accept what their report of pain is. Pain relief is a basic legal right, so we need to remember that because none of us want to get sued, and there have been cases where a person's pain has been undertreated or not treated properly, and they have won lawsuits in the millions of dollars. So we don't want any lawsuits. Nurses are ethically and legally responsible for managing pain and relieving suffering. So what does pain management entail? Pain management means that we are going to manage and reduce physical discomfort within our patients. If we do this, we're going to get the patients to get out of bed earlier, we're going to get them to return to work sooner, we're going to get them healing a lot quicker. It shortens the hospital stay and reduces healthcare costs, so everyone will be happy about that. Medicare and Medicaid will be happy if the patient doesn't stay for a very long time in the hospital. So this is just a slide, and it's showing you these are all the things we can do to help close in on pain. There's hypnosis, which we're going to talk about a little bit, massage. We could give injections, so pain medications, nutrition, exercise, relaxation, a positive attitude. How many of you think that a positive attitude can affect your perception of pain? Yeah. Like I said, pain is subjective. It's highly individualized. What I say is pain, severe pain for me, might not be severe pain for you. Pain can be caused by physical, or it can also be caused by emotional or mental things. Pain itself is tiring, and it places demands on a person's energy. Pain is actually one of the most common reasons why people go to a doctor. People don't tend to like going to doctors, so you know that the pain has to be pretty bad when they actually call the doctor and make an appointment for it. And you have to remember that pain can affect anyone. It can affect any age, any gender. It can interfere with relationships and influence the meaning of life. So we're going to talk about that a little bit later. If you're having chronic pain or pain that's not treated well, it can really affect your relationships with others. It can cause depression, anguish, anxiety. So pain cannot be objectively measured. There are certain types of pain that produce predictable symptoms. A nurse relies on the client's words and behaviors. So that's key to our assessment, what our patients are telling us. Pain itself is a protective physiologic mechanism, and it changes behavior. So pain can be acute. Acute means that it's short duration and that there's an identifiable cause. Chronic or persistent pain. Acute pain can actually turn into chronic pain. So if you have someone in acute pain and you're under treating it, it can actually turn into chronic pain. So that's why we want to make sure that we identify pain early and get it under control. There's idiopathic pain, so we're not sure what the cause is. Cancer pain. Pain by inferred pathology. It could be nociceptive and neuropathic, which we're going to talk about. And it could be pain as a result of metabolic needs or ischemic pain. So that's like our chest pains that we have. Nociceptive pain is the normal processing of stimuli that damages normal tissue or has the potential to do so if prolonged. So when we talk about physiological changes, what might you see in the patients that you're taking care of? What things might we look out for? What do you guys think?
You mean regarding pain?
Mm-hmm.
Like expression on the face.
Okay, so you might see it in the expression on the face.
Squeezing,
like grimacing.
Okay, is there any, what would you think about their vital signs? What would you see in someone who has pain? Right, you could see increased blood pressure, you could see an increased heart rate.
Increased respiration.
Respiration.
Sweating.
Sweating, that's good. Nociceptive pain is usually responsive to non-opioids or opioids, and they're somatic or visceral. So somatic pain arises from bone, joint, muscle, skin, or connective tissue. It's usually described by patients as aching, throbbing, well-localized pain. And it usually responds to traditional analgesia. So you see the Motrin listed at the bottom. So these are the people who might have some back pain. Maybe they have, they've run a long marathon and their legs are sore. This is the kind of thing that somatic pain is. Visceral pain is different. It arises from your visceral organs, so the GI tract, the heart, and the pancreas.
Can you repeat what somatic is again?
Sure. So somatic is, that's what comes from your bone and your joints, your muscles and skin. So somatic could be backache, it could be muscle strain.
Would that be like menstrual pain too? Like, is that muscle related?
I don't know if that would be more visceral because it's your uterus cramping up, I guess. So visceral pain can be divided a little bit further. You could have a tumor involvement of an organ. So if you have a tumor that's on your organ, you might have some visceral pain. You could have an obstruction of the hollow viscus, which would definitely lead to pain. Usually patients describe this type of pain as crampy and gnawing. Neuropathic pain is an abnormal processing of sensory input by the peripheral or central nervous system. So this could be the result of nerve damage. People often describe neuropathic pain as burning, tingling, pins and needles. Sometimes they have numbness. or they'll describe it as a shooting pain. Some diseases that are associated with this are diabetes, so you've heard of diabetic neuropathy. That's a type. Nerve entrapment. Sometimes people who have had a mastectomy, they might have a neuropathic pain. Treatment is usually with tricyclic antidepressants, SSRIs, and anticonvulsants. The pain is centrally generated, and it can be peripherally generated. Yes. Serotonin, it's a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. Okay. So it's another type of antidepressant.
Okay. Okay.
You're welcome. Idiopathic pain is chronic pain in the absence of an identifiable cause. And one of these that you might hear of, or two of these, are complex regional pain syndrome, so fibromyalgia. These are the people who have this pain that's chronic, but they don't really know what's causing it. Ischemic pain is the result of the metabolic need for oxygen. This is a big warning sign of tissue damage. So cardiac pain, someone who has angina or is having a heart attack. Vascular pain, so peripheral vascular disease, intermittent claudication. Who remembers what intermittent claudication is? Did you guys talk about that at all yet?
No.
Okay, so intermittent claudication is someone who is having pain. So they are, and it happens intermittently, so they are walking and they have pain and then they rest and it's gone. And that's a sign that something's wrong with them.
I have a question. Would angina be intermittent claudication?
No, angina itself is cardiac pain and it indicates that there is ischemic damage to the heart. Okay. And that's why with cardiac pain, when someone has it, we want to identify it right away and treat it because when someone's heart initially gets damaged to it, it has the chance to spread and get bigger. So if we can stop it before it spreads, that's the key to it. Okay, so nociceptive pain, it's actually a concept related to pain. And it involves transduction, transmission, perception, and modulation. Basically what transduction is there's a stimuli that's not good. And that stimuli converts energy into one of our nerve impulses. And then that's going to be perceived by these sensory receptors that are actually called nociceptors. So it's related to the word. Transmission is when the signal moves from the periphery to the spinal cord to the brain. So we're getting this stimuli that's not good, and then it is transmitting a signal throughout our entire body. And then we're perceiving that impulse as pain. And modulation basically is the inhibitory and facilitating input from the brain. So what that is going to do is it's going to affect how we kind of sense the pain.
You said it
Okay, so for transmission?
Yeah.
So what happens is we get that stimuli that's not good, it converts it into an energy, and that impulse is going to send a neural signal and it's going to move throughout our body.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So basically the pain isn't stagnant, it's going to keep, you know, moving up and down our body.
Can you give an example? Would it be like a bone or something like that?
It could probably happen with any type of pain. Like, let's say maybe you got hit by something. You know, you might get hit here, but then it sends the signal up and down, so you start to feel like an aching all over or a pain all over. The gate control theory of pain. So this is a theory that was developed on pain. Pain impulses can be regulated or even blocked by a gating mechanism along the central nervous system. The theory suggests that pain impulses pass when the gate is open and block when the gate is closed. Closing the gate is the basis for pain relief interventions. So it's like what I said, if I get hit with something, I'm gonna open up a pain gate and it could shoot it all throughout my body. So what we wanna do is close that gate and block it from going up and down my body. And then this is it more in detail. So this is a little bit of the pathophysiology of it. It involves the addition of mechanoreceptors, so A-beta neurons, which release inhibiting neurotransmitters, serotonin. And then if the dominant input is from A-beta fibers, gating mechanisms will close, pain is reduced due to the release of serotonin. So here it says that a back rub. So what they're saying is that a back rub could trigger the release of serotonin in someone and actually close that gate so that the pain isn't transmitted throughout your body. So you can see how antidepressants that affect someone's serotonin could help with the relief of pain, because it's doing the same thing. It's increasing that serotonin level and getting rid of the pain.
Can I ask you a question? So you're not talking about localized pain. You're talking about someone with fibromyalgia, for example.
It could be pain. It could be any type of pain for the gait theory. Depending on your body's response to it, you could open up the gait so that it travels throughout your whole body. So if you
if you step on a nail,
maybe for someone, they step on the nail and they just feel it in their foot. Other people might step on it and it shoots this pain up through your whole body and you feel it everywhere.
Okay.
So the physiologic response to pain, we talked a little bit about that. This is what you're going to see in the patients. Pain of low to moderate intensity and superficial pain elicit the fight or flight reaction. So sympathetic stimulation results in physiological responses. So if the pain stimulates my sympathetic stimulation, I'm going to have an increased heart rate, like we talked about. We're going to have peripheral vasoconstriction, which is going to cause my blood pressure to increase. We're going to have dilation of the bronchial tubes, and we might have an increased blood sugar. So these are all things you could see in your patient. If it's continuous pain or severe, deep visceral pain involving organs, it puts the parasympathetic system into effect. So now you're going to have the opposite result. You're going to have pallor. You're going to have a low blood pressure, a decreased heart rate. You might have nausea, vomiting, weakness, exhaustion. I know when I had my labor pains, I'm sure my heart rate was probably high, but at the same time, it was such pain that I felt so nauseous and like I wanted to vomit from it. So maybe it was stimulating both. So there's behavioral responses to pain. Pain threatens the physical and psychological well-being of someone. Some people choose not to express pain, and that could be due to their beliefs, their values, and cultural influences. So we have to remember that when we're assessing our patients. We have to keep in our minds, is there any barriers that we're not seeing? Is it a cultural thing? Is it a, you know, a religious thing? What are they showing us? Typical body movements that indicate pain are clenching teeth, a grimace, holding the area that hurts, and a bent posture. Acute pain, like I said, is short duration, so it's less than 6 months. It follows acute injury, disease, and surgical intervention. It usually has a rapid onset, and it can vary in intensity from mild to severe. Now, if we don't treat that acute pain, it can lead to chronic pain, which is pain that's greater than 6 months in duration. It can vary in intensity. It can also be known as chronic non-malignant pain. Types are arthritis, headache, low back pain. So you've seen, you might see patients with chronic low back pain. The longer someone has chronic pain, the harder it is to treat and get under control. I just want to go back to the chronic pain. So undertreated acute pain. So we talked about chronic, we talked about acute, but I wanted to reinforce that if you have undertreated acute pain, you can have really bad consequences in your patients. Patients could develop pneumonia, they could develop DVTs, impair their recovery. Why do you think a patient with undertreated acute pain would develop pneumonia?
He's not taking deep breaths.
Right, exactly. So they're having this pain, they're not taking deep breaths, and it can lead to pneumonia. What about DVT? Why would someone with acute pain be at risk for a DVT?
Not moving.
Right, because they're not moving. They don't want to move it. Exactly.
Heard that.
Cancer pain is pain that is due to tumor progression. It's related to pathology, invasive procedures, infections, and it can also be related to the chemotherapy that they're receiving. It can be acute or chronic, nociceptive or neuropathic. And at the actual site of where the tumor is, or distant to the site, which is known as referred pain.
What does nociceptive mean?
Nociceptive is that concept that we talked about with the transduction, transmission. So there's a lot of factors that influence pain. Someone's age, gender, culture, someone's own meaning of pain, attention, anxiety. So if you have someone with anxiety and now you're adding pain on top of it, they're going to be even more anxious. Fatigue, previous experience dealing with pain, coping styles, and family and social support. You know, someone who's in pain, if they don't have a good social support system when they leave the hospital, who's going to be helping them? If they don't have anyone helping them, it's going to lead them to more depression and anxiety because they have this pain. Maybe they can't feed themselves. Maybe they can't cook their meals. So we're going to talk about the nursing process of assessment. Pain is known as the fifth vital sign. So when you go to assess your patients and you take their vital signs, you also want to ask them about their pain. There are clinical practice guidelines. When we assess pain, we ask the client's expression of pain, their characteristics of the pain, onset, duration, and location and intensity. And probably in most of the hospitals that you're in, whether you chart on the computer or you chart with paper, there should be some kind of documentation on there about pain. Have you guys seen that? Can you use that? Okay. This shows you the numerical description of pain. So you can see that 0 is no pain and 10 is severe pain. This is the faces. And basically with this, sometimes people get confused because they think that, the nurses sometimes get confused because they go into the room and they think that they're gonna look at the patient and match them up with this, but that's not how it's supposed to work. What's supposed to happen is the patient is supposed to point to which picture it fits for them. So you can see how that could be a little bit confusing. So the Joint Commission, how many of you have heard of the Joint Commission? And what does the Joint Commission do? Right, evaluates the hospital, could shut us down. They are saying that they mandate compliance with pain management. And what they're saying is that every person has the right to have their pain assessed and reassessed. They have the right to adequate treatment. They say also that language is not a barrier. So you can't say, well, I went in to assess Mrs. Jones, but she doesn't speak English. It's not an option. You have to figure out a way to find out what her pain level is. We need to involve patients in pain management and educate them on what we're giving them. So that's a big role that we as nurses have to fulfill. We have to do all of this.
I have a question.
Yes.
When you chart that, since one is a scale of 10, one is a 5, do you just put down, what do you say? Faces and not faces?
Yeah. What? Okay. And in my hospital, for example, we have faces and we have a 0 to 10 scale. So we wouldn't try and correlate this to the 0 to 10 scale. This is its own separate scale that we know that if we pick 5, that's the worst pain. You know, if the patient points to 5, then that's the worst pain. We don't try and correlate it to the numerical scale.
But do you mention it? Like, do you know which scale you're meaning in the charting?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So you'll have the option of picking the numerical scale, or you could pick the
it's in the
scale.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. It's
all in the So we are definitely going to assess the quality of pain, the pain pattern, if they have any other symptoms with the pain. What is the pain doing to our patient? Are they having trouble meeting their ADLs?
Yes.
Excuse me. And then we want to make sure that we have cultural considerations in place. So nursing diagnosis. Who wants to throw a few out there before I show you what's up here. What kind of diagnoses do you think we could have for someone in pain?
Acute pain.
Okay, so
that's
pain,
my favorite.
Definitely.
Pain.
Anxiety. What else?
Activity intolerance.
Okay, so yeah, activity intolerance. Someone said problem sleeping.
Impaired mobility.
Impaired mobility, definitely.
I'm a nerd. I use that one a lot.
Somebody's cheating out there. Yes, could be. So implementation, what we're going to do. We can give them non-pharmacological and pharmacological methods. Non-pharmacological methods can lessen pain, and it's good because you can use them at home or in the hospital. We can utilize cognitive and behavioral and physical approaches, and we can allow patients some control. So these are the types of non-pharmacological methods: acupuncture, relaxation, guided imagery, distraction, biofeedback, self-hypnosis. Has anybody used any of these themselves? Anybody used acupuncture?
Andrew.
No. It's one that I want to try after
Andrew.
Yeah, we have someone in our clinical group who does acupuncture. And I don't know, kind of
biofeedback. With my chiropractor.
Yeah, I did that too.
My neck.
That actually feels good when it's done.
It does.
Yeah, it does. I don't know so much about the guided imagery. I guess it can work for certain people. It wouldn't work for me.
I do.
What did you say?
If you have it, if you have like a CD or like a MP3, it actually does work.
Those relaxation
like right before you go to sleep.
Where they say to imagine yourself at the beach or someplace pleasant. Sometimes that can be hard if you're in a lot of heat.
Yeah.
You can also use heat or massage. Here you can see they have pictures of the acupuncture, someone doing deep breathing. The TENS unit is actually a transcutaneous like stimulation. So it sends like little electrical
impulses.
I guess like impulses, and it's strategically placed. So like she said, when you go to the chiropractor, they'll put these patches over certain areas. So if I have back pain, they might align it in certain areas and deliver that electrical stimulation to try and reset everything and relieve the pain.
You do that in physical therapy.
Yeah, physical therapy.
They tried to move my kneecap back where it's supposed to be.
But you're so weird.
It's not where it's supposed to be.
This is just a picture of it again, so you can see the patches and the little box that goes along with it. And this is it actually on a patient. Then we have a nice heating pad, some ice packs, and good old massage. So pharmacologic methods definitely require a physician's order. There's guidelines set by regulatory agencies. Analgesics are the most common pharmacologic method. And we have a tendency to under-treat patients with pain meds. And that's due to our own biases that we have about pain. Analgesics, non-opioid or non-narcotic agents, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents. There's narcotics, opioids, adjuvants, which we're going to talk about, and co-analgesics. So the first one we're going to talk about are NSAIDs. This is very popular over-the-counter medication that a lot of people coming into the hospital might be on. It provides relief for mild to moderate pain. It's believed to inhibit prostaglandins and inhibits the cellular response during inflammation. It acts on peripheral nerve receptors to reduce the transmission and reception of pain. It does not cause sedation or respiratory depression, and it does not interfere with bowel or bladder function. We definitely want to make sure that we avoid prolonged or overuse in the elderly. We're going to talk about that. So NSAIDs are used in arthritic pain, minor surgical or dental procedures, low back pain. It should be initially used in mild to moderate post-op pain. Some common names are Motrin, Naprosyn, Indocin, and Toradol. So he said, why do we care about it in the elderly?
Renal.
What?
Renal.
Renal?
Yeah. It doesn't damage kidney or liver
sometimes, right? Not so much the...
Anti-inflammatory, maybe?
The intestinal bleeding?
Yes, intestinal bleeding is a major, major concern.
Yes.
And a lot of times, the elderly are at greater risk for this because they might be on other anticoagulants and it intensifies with it. When I was doing the... researching this, I actually found out that patients who are on NSAIDs for a week, just a week, 30% of them develop gastric ulcers. That's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
30% of people on it just for a week develop gastric ulcers. So you can see that NSAIDs are not something to be taken lightly. It's not something that you should be on for the rest of your life. And a lot of times people at home take NSAIDs a lot because, you know, maybe it's cheaper than going to the doctor and getting a prescription, and they don't realize the effect that it could have on them.
But it works, and it works good.
It does work, and it does work good, but you have to be careful with it. And that's where we come in we need to be educating our patients. So if someone's going home on an NSAID, we need to be educating them. What do you think they have to look out for? You need to look out for, you know, bloody stools, coughing, you know, throwing up blood, things like that, stomach pain.
But if they go to the doctors, what would, do you think they would prescribe? Substitute it with something else?
They might. They might prescribe something else. Opioids. Yes. Moderate to severe pain. It acts on the central nervous system and higher brain centers and spinal cord binding with opiate receptors. So it modifies the perception of our reaction to pain. Opioids, there's a risk for depression of vital nervous system functions, which we're going to talk about. If pain is anticipated for longer than 12 to 24 hours, around-the-clock timing should be used instead of PRN timing. So what that means is that if we suspect that the person is going to have longer than 24 hours worth of pain, we want to make sure that the doctor writes the order for you know, the opioid at 8 o'clock, 12 o'clock, you know, every 4 hours. We don't want to have to wait until the patient asks for it, which is what PRN is. We want to proactively give it to them. Opioids can be used effectively with the elderly, but we have to remember to start low and go slow. So we don't want to give someone the highest dosing of opioids and knock them completely out. We want to start with the lowest dose possible and work our way up. So what are some things, what are some side effects of opioids that we need to educate our patients about?
Constipation.
Constipation, that's a huge one. Constipation can start from the first day that you take an opioid. So we want to make sure that our patients have maybe a stool softener ordered for them, that we're encouraging them to eat and to tell us if they haven't gone to the bathroom. What else could it do?
They depress respiratory center?
Right, so it could depress their respiratory center. So when we're giving someone opioids, we need to monitor them and see, you know, what is their respiratory rate? Are they overly sedated? If we see that we've just given someone an opioid and they're breathing, you know, maybe six times a minute, we have to do something about it. So it's not something to be taken lightly. And usually the respiratory depression happens when we initially give an opioid for the first time. So if I were to get an opioid, I'd never have taken any of these medicines. If I were to get it, you know, I could have the potential for slowing down my respirations and possibly, you know, coding. So we really have to check for that in our patients. Some common names are morphine, Demerol, codeine, Percocet, fentanyl, and hydromorphone. We definitely need to know that Narcan is going to reverse the effects of the opioid. It works rather quickly, and I've seen it used in patients who have had too much of an opioid, and as soon as we give it, they bolt up, it totally clears the opioid out of their body, and it's not such a happy time for them. So adjuvant therapy, this is when we use sedatives, anti-anxiety meds, muscle relaxants, in addition to what we're already giving the patient. And this can enhance pain control or relieve the symptoms associated with pain. So some common names are Vistril, Elavil, Thorazine, Valium, Ativan, and of course Xanax.
Patient has so many antidepressants.
Yes.
There are most of them. And lipid lowering agents. That's another one. Nursing homes? Oh my God.
You suspect that they have OD on Percocet or something like that. Do you ask the patient and they'll tell you what's going on if they're afraid that you might, do you just automatically give them Narcan?
They could if they come into the emergency room and there's strong suspicion that maybe they did overdose themselves on it, they could. Or they could draw some blood work on the patient and see if that would show anything. But if it's really an emergent situation, then they'll probably try to give the Narcan and see if that works. And if it doesn't, then they know that that's not what it is. So this is just the World Health Organization's three-step model to the treatment of pain. So it shows you mild, moderate, and severe, and the different types of medications that we can give the patient at the each of the levels. Patient-controlled analgesia, or PCA, it's a drug delivery system, and it allows patients to have control over their pain therapy. It's a safe method for post-op, traumatic, or cancer pain. There is self-administration without the risk of overdose, and it is IV administration. So usually what happens with a PCA is that the doctor orders it. And I know at our hospital they have a PCA order form, and the doctor will order a loading dose, a continuous rate, an on-demand dose, so if I press that button it's going to deliver something to me. And then we can also set it for hourly maximum amounts. That means that no matter how many times I press that button, maybe the doctor locked it out every 15 minutes. So even if I press it 20 times, I'm only going to get the medicine every 15 minutes. And PCAs are, you know, sometimes they use, I've seen PCAs used post-operatively, so, you know, someone who's had surgery might be on a PCA. Someone who, I know myself, after I had my C-section, the spinal that they gave me didn't work, so I was hooked up to a PCA pump afterwards. And I think I did press it too much because I got really, really nauseous from it. And sometimes people coming in with like sickle cell crisis, they might initially put them on a PCA pump. Then there's the local and regional anesthetics. So, you know, if we are gonna do some wound suturing, we wanna make sure that that area is numbed up before we do any suturing. Delivery of a baby, simple surgeries. Epidural analgesia for post-op pain management, labor and delivery pain, and chronic cancer pain. There is something called an on-cue pain pump. I don't know how much, we used to use it a lot at my hospital, but we've really gotten away from it. So I don't know how often it's really used anymore. And this is just a picture of someone getting a spinal. You can see that it's a sterile procedure. This is a picture of the on-cue pain pump. Epidural management can be short or long-term. It's administered into the spinal epidural space. The catheter is actually left in place and secured with tape and a dressing. It can be a continuous infusion or a daily injection. And this is kind of an anatomical picture of what's going on. Another picture of it. So when we have someone on epidural pain management, we need to monitor them hourly. We need to check to see if the catheter has displaced, that the catheter is functioning, if the person is having any respiratory depression, because, you know, it's going into their spinal area, so let's say that it is displaced in some way, then the medication can travel up further and it can, you know, cause respiratory depression. We need to monitor for any side effects like nausea, vomiting, itching, urinary retention. Usually when someone gets a spinal or an epidural, they put a Foley catheter in them. And we want to see what the effect on their pain has been. Another picture of it. Cancer pain management. They usually use long-acting preparations, things that are sustained release. Drug dependence is low in cancer-related pain. A lot of times people who have cancer are on very high doses of pain medication. They don't have a tendency to be dependent because they do have so much pain. They can develop tolerance requiring the higher doses. And the goal is to minimize pain rather than to cure it. So we know that with cancer pain, we're not going to get rid of it completely, but we want to try and minimize it to the best of our ability. Okay, so for pain management, we want to make sure that we're turning patients, because like I said, these people are not going to want to turn and reposition themselves, and we don't need them on top of having pain getting a pressure ulcer. So we need to make sure we're turning and repositioning them. Yeah, I think Donna must have added this in because I don't have it either. She added this in last minute to throw me for a loop. It's not in my packet either. We want to make sure we get our patients out of bed, and we want to make sure that there's orders for physical therapy for them. So if they do have pain, maybe we want to get the physical therapist involved and see what they recommend.
Can
you
turn
it
back?
Yes. Is everybody okay with that? This is a crazy picture of all the things that can happen with pain. And you can see how much is really involved when someone is going through pain. Okay, before we do our clicker questions, I have this. I didn't know if we would have enough time. So what we're going to do is I'm going to break you guys up into